some long circuit, and there's a fixed noise channel acting on it. And another way of seeing this difference is to look at the diamond distance from identity. So it's defined in this way as a optimization over rho states of the system and an ancilla, and then induced trace norm, but that's not so important to us. But as far as we're concerned, what matters is that this is the norm that's going to appear in a threshold theorem, for example. Whereas the norm that we more likely have access to is something like the average infidelity. For an incoherent noise channel, there's no problem in equating these two. But for a unitary noise channel, the distance, diamond distance from identity goes like the square root of r. And so if we're talking about a noise channel with low infidelity, something that we would expect in a good quantum device, then if we just have access to r, we would make very different predictions of the diamond distance from identity based on whether the noise channel was coherent or incoherent. Now, you're probably aware that this coherent noise question is not a new one, and it's been studied a lot. And people have worked at, for example, at mitigating coherent errors. You can do some kind of dynamical decoupling or randomized compiling, or you could just understand your device better and cancel the unitary error you might have. But the reason we still are studying this question is because none of these corrections you can do are going to be perfect. There's always going to be some non-Markovianity that makes it violate randomized compiling or something. And we might worry that in the fault-tolerant regime where we're constructing some enormous code to get an extremely small logical error rate, we might worry that in some way the coherence of the noise was accumulating. That even though it was pretty small at the physical level, somehow the logical level it was still very coherent. Maybe that would be surprising, but it's nice to have a proof that that doesn't happen, at least under certain assumptions. So we're going to work with the Tor code here. And I have this slide just introducing the Tor code, although you're all probably familiar already. So we just take a 2D square lattice and we put qubits at the edges. And now the stabilizer operators are going to be, the generators are going to be Z on plaquettes and X on the vertices like that. And then we'll be talking a lot later about the logical strings. And they look roughly like this. They're strings that wrap around the lattice one way or another. And they can be strings of X's or Z's. So why have we chosen the Tor code? Well, the proof will be pretty difficult, so we need something simple to analyze. And the Tor code is the simplest example of a topological code. And topological codes are a nice class to study for several reasons, but they have good decoding that we understand pretty well. They have a high threshold. And for our purposes, they're nice because they're already an infinite family of codes that we can look at, because we want to get at this asymptotically large code limit. And of course, 2D is the simplest Tor code, and it happens to also be the one that's easiest to realize physically, perhaps. Now, we'll talk later about why we expect that all stabilizer codes will behave roughly the same way in terms of suppressing the coherence. But we've basically chosen the simplest code we could that we expect to still be representative of us, topological codes and stabilizer codes in general. So now, before we start talking about the logical noise channel, we need to talk about these two representations of a noise channel. So this first one is called the Pauli transfer matrix representation. So this is the noise channel acting on some state rho, and we just expand the density operator in basis of n-qubit Pauli operators, and then the channel acts in this way. So this ij component basically maps sigma j to sigma I. And this representation is useful partly because there's a quantity we'll be using called the unitarity, which is easy to calculate in terms of this representation. But what we'll actually use to describe the error correction part is this chi matrix or process matrix. So here, this is very similar. They're related by a linear transformation, but in this case, n acting on our state rho gives this. So it's expanding the Krauss operators of the noise channel into Pauli's. That's a way of thinking about it. And I'm going to use a notation that I don't think is standard, but will be very helpful, which is this. So the ijth component of this matrix, I'm going to write like this. Just parentheses and the term in the sum that corresponds to that matrix element. And we'll probably see why that's useful later. And just a remark that in both of these representations, the incoherent parts of the channel will be diagonal. So every Pauli operator is diagonal in both of these representations. Now we're ready to talk about error correction. So we have to say precisely what we're going to do. So we're going to do just a single round of error correction. We're going to encode our logical information. We're going to act with the physical noise channel. Then we're going to decode. And part of the decoding is we measure all our stabilizers, and we decode the error. And we're going to average over syndromes, which is actually crucial to the result. So we'll see in a few slides that if we consider some particular syndrome, we will in general expect possibly large coherence to survive. But it's only after averaging that we see that the coherence is suppressed. And we're also going to assume that this syndrome extraction is perfect. We could treat measurement errors without too much trouble because most of the errors in measurement, errors on the ancilla before or after the two-qubit gate, will not propagate to coherent errors in the bulk, just incoherent ones in the code. But an error in the two-qubit gate could potentially introduce a coherent error in the code. But then we sort of will wrap that up into our noise channel N. So this N sort of encompasses all of the noise that's going to act on our code in between the encode and decode step. And the tilde is always going to represent a logical operator here. So the logical noise channel will be the composition of encode, noise, and decode.
Question?
Yes?
And would the analysis be much more complicated if you were to consider multiple rounds of error correction with possible measurement errors?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the analysis might be slightly complicated if you are not in the code state when the noise acts on you. I haven't thought about that. But I don't think it would be a huge complication. But it would be something. You'd have to do a little bit of extra work. So now we can write an expression for this logical noise channel. So we wanna use the chi matrix, and we're going to expand each component of this channel in terms of the components of this channel. And we can do that in this equation here, which has a lot of notation, but I'll explain it. So this is the AB component of the logical chi matrix. So this is chi tilde sub A comma B. And then on the right-hand side, we have a sum over physical noise terms. So error correction is going to act on both sides of rho here. And if the syndrome is not the same for the errors on left and right, it will be mapped to zero. So in other words, for the only physical noise terms that enter into the logical noise are the ones where there's the same S on each side. We have A and B, which match the indices A and B over here. These are representatives of the logical A and B maps. And then SI and SJ are just stabilizer group elements. And we sum over all stabilizers on both sides and over all syndromes. And the equation is compact, but it's also very hard to do anything with because for any large code, the number of stabilizers is enormous. So this is not just a sum over generators, it's a sum over all group elements. And also there are a ton of different syndromes. So it's not obvious that we're going to be able to do anything with this. And that's where the simple calculation comes in and gives us some intuition. So I'm gonna go through the whole thing pretty much. I hope you will bear with me, but it'll just be 5 slides. So we start with a repetition code of n qubits. We have check operators, the two body z's, nearest neighbors, and then a logical operator is just x acting on every qubit. And we're going to apply a unitary rotation, the same one, about x, to every qubit. And now we want to just look at an off-diagonal component of chi. So the off-diagonal components are the ones that correspond to coherent parts of the noise channel. So this will be a coherent component. And there's only one that's non-trivial. It's this x, 0 component. And translating the equation from 2 slides ago gives us this. So there are no other representatives of the logical map that we need to consider, because this is the only representative that's made up entirely of exit errors. So there's no sum over stabilizers here. There's just a sum over syndromes. And that's simple enough that we can handle it. So each term in this sum is going to look something like these two terms down here. So we have the logical x error, x on all 5 qubits here. And then we multiply by some syndrome. And this is the correction for that syndrome. And each syndrome is just going to be some subset of less than half of the qubits. So in this case, it's the 3rd and 5th qubit. And so this term here basically consists of partitions of the logical map into a right operator and a left operator. So it's two disjoint operators that multiply to give you the logical map.
Just to clarify, so this represents the channel that is basically the encoding, error, decoding.
Yes. So now we can just perform the sum. Each syndrome is some subset of less than half of the qubits, like I said. And the number of those will be n choose j, where j is the weight of the syndrome. The interesting thing here is that we have this phase, this sign, in the sum. And this comes from the I sine theta. So we have I sine theta that comes along with each x error, and minus I sine theta comes along with each x error on the right side of rho and I on the left. And together, these give us this alternating sign. And this is actually crucial to the suppression of the coherence, this cancellation that happens. So we can use a little trig or a little binomial coefficient identity to perform this sum, and it gives us this single coefficient. And this is, we've just exactly calculated the off-diagonal 1-0 component of the chi matrix for the logical noise. And now we can do the same for the incoherent component. So this is the 1-1 component, which corresponds to an x error on each side of rho. So that's what we have here. It looks a lot like the sum in the previous case, except now the left-hand side operator has been duplicated on the right. It's the same operator on each side. So that sum looks like this. Now, in the previous sum, there was actually the same factor of theta for every term. And this was because of these partitions. There were the same number of x errors in each term. But here there aren't. And so we'll just take the lowest order term. And that looks like this. And choose n minus 1 over 2. And there's sine theta to the n plus 1. And now that we've computed both these components, we can just compare them. And it looks like this. The coherent logical noise component is proportional to the incoherent one, and the constant has this cosine theta over sine theta. So if theta, which is the rotation angle on each qubit, is small, then it looks like the coherent part can be much bigger than the incoherent part, which is true. But we're not really going to be interested in the behavior with respect to theta, because we want a result that sort of can accompany a threshold theorem. So we're thinking in the regime of fixed theta and increasing n, the code size. So in that regime, these two components are just proportional. And we can compute the unitarity of this logical noise map, and then we can use a result from Carignan Dugas et al. And prove this statement about the growth of infidelity. So the infidelity of the logical noise channel after m applications is linear in the infidelity of a single application of the channel, plus this quadratic term that is smaller than this term by a factor of the logical infidelity. So there's r here and r squared over here. And as the code size increases, r is going to be exponentially small if we're below the threshold. And so what this lets us say is that the logical noise channel, its infidelity grows linearly up to a small correction. And that's exactly the sort of result we want to prove for the Tor code now. So this is our theorem. And there's a lot of words, but it's very similar to what we just proved for the repetition code. So we're going to consider a 2D Tor code with size L, and we're going to use minimum weight decoding for simplicity. And we have periodic boundary conditions also for simplicity. And now our noise model will be unitary rotations by some angle. And there's a threshold for this angle, and it can't be too large, or else our techniques don't work. And that threshold turns out to be 0.19 radians for the angle of rotation. And then we have two statements about the suppression of coherence. One in terms of the diamond distance from identity. So here the diamond distance from identity is proportional to r up to some constant. They're not equal, but there's this constant that does not scale with n, or l, the code size. And then we also have this statement about logical growth of infidelity, and it looks just like the statement we saw where there's m times r is the first term, and then the second term is m squared r squared, which is a lot smaller if the code is large. And also, this statement applies if we have not a fixed rotation on each qubit, but we have arbitrary rotations of any axis and angle, so long as the logical, it's the result sort of works that we have a result for constant noise channel, and then if you change the angles in such a way that the logical noise strength, the infidelity, is the same, then the coherence is less. So in other words, the maximum coherence happens for this case where all angles and axes are the same. And then we've also proved a statement about correlated noise. So if we now allow, we now say that our unitaries don't have to be single body unitaries, but there's some two-body unitary part. We also have proven a similar statement. And now, if there aren't any questions, I'll start sketching the proof. So the proof will be, in a few words, just to apply the repetition. Yes?
So basically, can you go back?
Yes.
So you're talking about like that there's a threshold for an angle,
yes,
rotation, but you can equivalently phrase it in terms of the strength,
yes,
of the logical noise. And that's,
yes,
that's basically the one you use when your rotations are along arbitrary axes and arbitrary angles.
Not exactly. I'll get to that. I have a slide for that part, and I think I'll explain it better there. So our plan will be to try to do something analogous to the repetition code for each logical string. So here's a logical string in the Tor code. We can perform a sum not over all syndromes, but a sum over a restricted set of syndromes where the errors lie along this logical string. And that sum sort of looks like the one we just did for the repetition code. But of course, there are a few problems. So our syndromes aren't just these connected components. They also have all sorts of disconnected components far away from the string. And we have to argue that we can, in some way, factor these. And then we have to perform the sum for this particular string. It won't be exactly the same as the repetition code. There'll be a twist, depending upon the shape, for example. And then also, we'll have to sum over all possible logical strings. But this is the general idea of how we do it, but I haven't told you anything about why it's possible. So if you allow me to consider just this logical string and the restricted set of syndromes that lie along it, then there's this problem we encounter immediately. Also, let's say that we're considering just this class of coherent logical components, where we have a non-trivial logical operator on one side and identity on the other. But now let's look at this logical string and try to do the sum over syndromes like we did before in the repetition code. The problem we encounter is that this is one physical noise term that might that will appear in our sum. So this blue error corresponds to the right-hand side, and the red error corresponds to the left-hand side of rho in our sum. But what's different here is that the blue error is actually higher weight than the red one, roughly speaking, because it has little caps like this, where the decoding will specify this error instead of the three around it. But this complicates our sum enormously, because now each term that looks like this actually has the opposite sign of what we'd expect from the repetition code calculation. So it looks like we can't really use it at all, and instead we're going to have to do a unique sum for every possible string shape, which seems impossible. But the tool we're going to use here is path counting. So this probably isn't surprising to you, because path counting is always used with the Torah code to prove thresholds and such. But this is actually a little different than, for example, the path counting you would do if you were trying to prove the threshold for stochastic noise in the Torah code, because we're not adding up probabilities for each logical string. We need to add amplitudes. In other words, we need to keep track of these phases and the signs. So it's not, for example, there's a very simple upper bound we can write for the number of logical strings of a given length in a code of a given size. It's just this, it has this three to the W factor, basically, because you're moving along on this lattice and you're self-avoiding, so you can't go backwards. So there are three choices you make at each turn. But that doesn't help us, because we have to keep track of these phases. If we have this alternating sum and we just have a bound on the magnitude of each term, the only thing we can do is put together this pessimistic sum where we just add them all with the same sign. And as we saw with the repetition code, that's not good enough to show that the coherence is suppressed. So what we have to do is this. We have this asymptotic form. It looks like this. So the number of strings of a given weight W is approximately equal to this. So there's this mu, which is the important factor. It's mu to the W. And then there's this polynomial W to the alpha minus 2 factor. And alpha depends on the dimension, and mu depends on the particulars of your lattice. But for the square lattice, it's this, it's 2.64. It's a little less than 3, which is what the naive bound gives you. So we're going to use this to truncate our sum over logical strings. We're going to cut it off at some threshold. And then we'll be left just with these shorter logical strings. And then we will have to actually perform the sum over the shorter logical strings. So the truncation looks like this. We pick some constant k, and we're going to truncate. We're going to neglect all strings of length longer than l plus 2k. And it turns out the error we make in doing this is exponentially small in k, assuming that theta is below this threshold value. This is where the 0.19 comes from. So the threshold value is such that the contribution of the logical string of this length, roughly speaking, it's theta to the W times this. The threshold is such that the contribution from that string is exponentially small in W. And if it's exponentially small in W, then we can truncate in this way. And we'll see that this is enormously helpful because these short strings are easy to analyze. So in particular, we had this problem with, I call them exceptional terms, but where the partition of the logical string into two is such that the correctable string is higher weight than the uncorrectable string. We can show that for short strings, this case is rare. And that lets us perform the sum with some small error. A second difficulty we run into very quickly is that in the repetition code, in the incoherent sum, it was very simple because we had the same error on each side of row. And in particular, that gave us no phases. The same error on each side meant that the contribution was just plus one. But in this sum, which is an incoherent logical term now, we have to keep this sum over stabilizers. What this means is that now there's a different error on each side of row. And what we have are physical noise terms that are coherent, but under error correction, they map to the incoherent part of the logical noise channel. And this is difficult for us because now we don't have the same weight on each side of row, and we have to deal with the phases. There are now plus and minus contributions to the incoherent logical noise. And I don't have time to go into any detail, but it turns out that path counting comes to the rescue here as well. That by restricting to short logical strings, we can prove that the contribution of a certain set of terms is negligible. And then we're able to do this sum in a reasonable way. And I can't go into too much more detail about the proof, but I just listed a few more difficulties we ran into here. So we needed to prove a lemma about the shape of logical strings. And this is basically what lets us analyze the short logical strings. It's because we can prove something strong about the shape. We have to do this addition over strings, but we need to make sure that we don't accidentally double count any terms. We also haven't justified the statement that we can approximately factor out this disconnected part of the syndrome, but it turns out that for short logical strings we can. Then I haven't mentioned physical or logical Y errors, but it turns out that for short logical strings, we can show that we can neglect these terms. Also, I haven't said anything about coherent terms where we have indices A and B, where they're both not identity. They're both non-trivial. But it turns out these are also negligible because they have higher weight, much higher weight than the terms that we kept. And I also haven't told you how we prove the statements about growth of infidelity and diamond distance. The way we do it is via this unitarity, which is defined by Wallman and Flamia and others. But what we have to do is bound the unitarity in terms of the chi matrix, which took a little bit of work. Yes?
I'm just curious what you could have proven about the shape of logical strings.
So it's not too sophisticated, really. But what we prove is that here's a relatively short logical string, where short is in relation to minimum length. What we prove is that it basically consists of a number of steps. It doesn't, for example, it's unlikely to have something like that. It's likely to consist of steps like this. And moreover, these steps are likely to be spaced by something like some gamma times L, some constant times L. And that's what lets us prove that our sum over syndromes works and a bunch of other stuff works. So I don't have time to really tell you anything about these, but these are the things we had to do. But I will say something now about arbitrary angles. So far we've considered the case where our unitary noise channel on each single qubit is identical. But we can extend it to the case where we have arbitrary axes and angles in the following way. We take our calculation, we take our the logical noise channel that we calculated, and we consider what happens if we change the angles. But we change them in such a way that the logical noise strength is unchanged. This gives us sort of a manifold of possible configurations. And then we write down what we know about the function, so the logical noise component as a function of all of the single angles. And then we just do some simple calculus to show that there's a maximum at the point where all the thetas are the same. Maybe that was fast, but the idea is that fix the diagonal components, or the sum of the diagonal components of the logical noise, consider changing all of the angles. The statement is that the off-diagonal components of the noise are only reduced. That is, the maximum is at the point where all the angles are the same. We also worked on correlations. So we wanted to model correlations between the qubits, so where we have at least some component of two-body unitary, not just one-body unitary. And we do it in this way. So we do it with a Hamiltonian. So we have some X rotation that acts single body on every qubit, and then we have some two-body X rotation that acts jointly on every pair of qubits. So this is not very physical because it couples every pair of qubits no matter where they're located. But it has the advantage of being tractable. The reason that nearest neighbor couplings was really hard is because we have these sums over in the coherent terms, we have these sums over partitions where we split our logical operator into two parts, and counting them becomes really difficult if you have to keep track over the number of nearest neighbors in this partition. And so that was the obstacle there. But we can, this model is simple enough that we can analyze it. And when we do, we find that the coherence is still suppressed. Of course, exactly the numbers work out differently, but the conclusion is essentially the same. So here's the theorem. It's the same theorem again. Are there any questions? Yes.
Theta is supposed to be very small, right?
Yes.
Then the second term with the mr squared.
Yes.
Has a 1 over sine theta.
Yes, that's right.
So that will become very big.
Yes, if you think of fixed n and changing theta. But that's not the way we're thinking. So we want to think like a threshold theorem where the physical noise strength is fixed, and we're trying to make a bigger and bigger code such that the logical noise strength is more and more suppressed. But another thing I can say is that this R here also depends on theta. But it's actually like theta to the code distance. So if you keep that in mind, then it doesn't look bad. But that's right, it is a counterintuitive feature. Yes?
So it seems that when the theta is very small is when you get a problem there. But is that counterintuitive? I mean, shouldn't like smaller unitaries be easier to use?
Well, so you can see the same thing by just looking at single qubit channels. When there's a block sphere picture, I think, that might help. But if we start up here, sort of the unitary way to move is like that. And the incoherent way to move is like that. And somehow, if we're moving like that by a really small amount, it ends up looking more like the unitary than the incoherent, but again, I think the way to think about it is to fix theta and increase distance. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I have another question. So your result is all this time on R, but does this automatically translate to like a Fresnel theorem?
No. So our result is sort of compatible with a threshold theorem, but it's not any kind of threshold statement.
Okay.
So in particular, it's not claiming anything about the size of R or the diamond distance. It's just saying that they're related in this way. All right, so I wanted to mention some future work that could be done on this. So the most obvious limitation of what we've done is that it applies only to the Tor code with minimum weight decoding. But there's nothing about either of those, the code or the decoding, that should be essential to the result. The phenomenon is simply the stabilizer measurement is scrambling the unitaries, roughly speaking. And that happens the same way in every stabilizer code. So it would be nice to extend this in some way to make it more generally applicable. Also, it would be nice to have some numerics to answer the question of how tight our bound really is for some fixed code size. You know, we were focused on the large code limit, but it would be interesting to see what it says about some finite size code. And then finally, there is a flaw in our correlation calculation in that our model is probably not the most natural one. So yes.
I was wondering, when you take a sum over different syndromes.
Yes.
Isn't the sum like a weighted sum and not a uniform sum, because different syndromes have different probabilities?
Yes. Yes. Indeed.
Does this thing still hold if you take a weighted sum?
No, the result is for a weighted sum.
Okay.
You know, it's weighted by the probability. It's the expectation of over, yeah. I just realized that I neglected to make the point I wanted to make about averaging over syndromes. Let me see if I can make it now. So if, it's a simple point I want to make. It's just that say we have the Tor code, and we want to restrict ourselves to, we want to post-select on the trivial syndrome. And now we want to compute the logical noise channel. We can just think at lowest weight now to get a rough idea, but the lowest weight coherent term looks like this schematically. There's this operator on one side of rho and identity on the other, whereas the lowest order incoherent term looks something like this. It's a non-trivial logical string on both sides. And as you can see, the size of those components can't be equal. You know, this is squared of the other one. And so if you post-select on the trivial syndrome, you expect to see no suppression of coherence. It's the highest weight syndromes that give the most suppression, and those end up dominating because of cancellations in the coherent. We had those alternating minus signs in the coherent sum, and that was the key. That's all I wanted to talk about. I have some references here. Thank you. Yes?
I have a question. So, is there a reason to expect that your all-to-all
yes.
Correlations and noise model is less harmful than nearest neighbor correlations?
I can't think of one, because when we did the calculation, we were just looking at one of these sums over syndromes, so like one copy of repetition code. Or one logical string. And in that case, it seems like any correlation is harmful in some sense. And nearest neighbor shouldn't be qualitatively different from all to all. But. Yes?
So, it's more correct me, but there was a paper by Chab and Flamia where Did they have threshold theorem for coherent errors?
So there are definitely threshold theorems for coherent errors.
Okay, so
yeah, yeah.
How do they compare to? Because you said this, your result is consistent with the existence of a threshold. No? Can you compare like bounds or like the angle you get?
So their statement is about the strength of the noise. So they're trying to bound the diamond distance from identity of the logical noise channel. And we're doing something different. We're trying to bound the, well, we're trying to relate the coherent and incoherent components of the logical noise channel. I don't know off the top of my head how our threshold compares with their threshold, but I'm not sure it's a meaningful comparison to make because they're different things. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you use this finite analysis of self-averting walks, mm-hmm. in 2.64.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you use theta to the power m, then that would be just a worse bound on theta. That would not work.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
I mean, that should give some bound.
Yes, yes. It's probably only a small advantage.
Yeah, really. It's looking at the one way good.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
So, you said that you have this little lemma about the shape of low weight logical operators. And so it seems that if you have, you know, the square lattice,
yes,
at the number of low weight operators scales polynomially in L.
Yes.
Whereas if you were to rotate the lattice, that would be exponential, no?
Yes.
Could that be harmful?
The counting would be completely different. I don't know what the result would be, but you would have to start from the beginning and do the counting in a different way. Although the same sort of path counting would apply, the actual calculation you do would have to be significantly different.
And I have so if you were to take you don't perceive any problems with translating your logics from the Torah code to, say, unitary equivalent models.
I can't imagine a problem there.
Which maps one to the other.
Yeah. That should work. Yeah, in the back.
What happens to your, the proof only works with this particular fixed angle. What goes wrong when you have an angle that's above that sort of thing?
What goes wrong is that the path counting no longer tells us that the contribution of increasingly longer strings is decaying. So we don't have we don't know that the tail is exponential, and we can't really say anything in that case. Yeah. Yeah.
So do you have any intuition about why certain paths are more likely than the one that you said is unlikely?
The intuition is just that a path of length L plus 2k for fixed k, as L increases, this is just going to look more and more like a straight line. Like as L increases, k becomes smaller relative to L. It's just the statement I'm making. And that means that if you make the code bigger and bigger and it has the same k, then the string looks more and more like lowest weight.
If there are no further questions, let's thank Joe again.